Thank you very much, and thanks a lot to the organizers for the invitation. It's really a great pleasure to be here. The good thing is that after all these exciting talks, I can skip most of my introduction. I was inspired by the history part of the recent talk today about physiology, which we call today electrophysiology. So just want to briefly mention that also neuromechanics actually has a quite long history. So with the discovery of glial cells, you see an astrocyte, which has a star-like shape because it's called astrocyte. Astro means star. So with the discovery of glial cells more than 150 years ago, the first supposed function of these cells was a mechanical one. So they were supposed to offer mechanical support to neurons to act as a mechanical scaffold. Somehow this idea has been lost in between, but we are rediscovering it, I guess. So I will talk about mechanosensitivity of cells in the nervous system. In order to understand mechanosensitivity of cells, we have to know first how the mechanical environment of cells looks like, right? So we have to know something about the mechanical properties of nerve tissue. And this is what I want to start my talk with. So in the first part of it, I will show you some data on the mechanical properties of nerve tissue. And then in the second part, I will first show you some data on mechanosensitivity of neurons. And in the end, I will briefly talk about mechanosensitivity of glial cells. All right, let's start with mechanics. As we have heard already, mechanics is a pretty complex thing, so it's not possible to just give a number for a property of nerve tissue. So it's a viscoelastic material, which means that its response to a stress or a strain depends on the time scale. So what you can do to measure mechanical properties of tissue slices or of pieces of tissue is either like shear tests with a rheometer, as indicated here. So you basically have a plate, you shear it, and you measure the response of the tissue. Or you can also do tensile tests and pull on it, and you will end up with plots that may look like this one here, where you see some kind of modulus, and this kind is the complex shear modulus, independent of the frequency you probe the tissue with. And actually, I had to change the slide slightly yesterday. I used to abbreviate hippocampus with HC, and I thought if I leave it like this, everybody would think today it's hydrocephalus. So anyway, so what you see here is the complex shear modulus of hippocampus slices and of retinal tissue. And you see that G prime, which is a measure of the elastic response of material, is dominating. So nerve tissue is rather an elastic material, and of course depending on the time scale, and that the modulus is rather low, so shear modulus is on the order of 100 Pascal. All right, but we do in these measurements, we average over a pretty large volume, so we average over thousands or millions of cells, of different types of cells and blood vessels and extracellular matrix. We've heard about this before. So in order to see whether this tissue is mechanically inhomogeneous, which we would expect, we have to do some other measurement. And one way of measuring local mechanical properties of tissue is using atomic force microscopy or scanning force microscopy. Just to remind you, the core piece of such an atomic force microscope is the so-called cantilever, which is just a soft leaf spring that can be used to apply well-defined forces to the tissue, and you respond then how much you just record how much you deform the tissue, and you can infer modulus again out of this. So we modify our atomic force microscope or our cantilevers by gluing a polystyrene beads to the tips. And we can vary these polystyrene beads in sizes, and which has the advantage that we can choose first the resolution that we have and the area we want to average the mechanical properties over. And the advantages of these beads is first that you minimize damage to the cell. If you look at this original sharp tip of a cantilever, you can imagine that you can easily penetrate the tissue and destroy the tissue. And also, you get a well-defined contact area, which is much easier to model. So, and using these geometries, We did some local measurements on cerebellar brain slices, and this is the first thing we found. So actually what you see here, this is, we tried different indentation depths, so to see how nonlinear the tissue response is. And this is, in this case, the Young's modulus. So which is just, you take the shear modulus if you apply forces perpendicular to the surface, and this will be normal to the surface. And I will use the Young's modulus throughout the rest of my talk. So this can be converted into each other using Poisson's ratio. And what you see here in this plot, there is two important information. So the first one is, so you have always white and gray matter in comparison with each other. The first information, which is very important here, is that we found that, actually in contrast to what we heard yesterday, that gray matter is significantly stiffer than white matter. And this is something we see already in our raw data, so in the force curves. You apply the same force, and you indent much, much deeper in white matter, which is a clear indication that white matter is actually more compliant. And the second information is that this tissue at these indentation depths is not is rather linear, which was surprising to us. So, and we can then use our AFM technique to get mechanical maps of the tissue, right? So that's what we've done in the next step. And what you see here on the left-hand side is, this is just a microscopic image of some cerebellar slice. The white, so this would be a part of a folding of a gyrus. This white structure in here, which we couldn't measure, if there is no tissue, this is just a fold, so it would be filled with the CSF. This brighter structure here, this is gray matter, and finally the dark structure is white matter. And you see clearly here that you can mechanically very well distinguish gray from white matter. Of course, this is still, so this has a spatial and lateral resolution of 100 microns, which is still rather large. You know, cells are on the order of tens of microns in length. So we were wondering, how about cells? What if we compare cells with each other? So we isolated cells from the nervous tissue. And yeah, this is just an indication here. You see, this is an electron microscopy picture of a retinal, of the inner nuclear layer in the retina. And these, oops, sorry, these round nuclei here are neurons, neuronal cell bodies. And this one here, which is indented, significantly indented by the neighbors, this would be some of the glial cell. So you see that neurons indent glial cells, which already suggests that they are stiffer. And we quantified this using atomic force microscopy. This is data of acutely isolated cells from the central nervous system. On the left-hand side, again, hippocampus. And on the left-hand side, hippocampus. On the right-hand side, retina tissue. And in both cases, neurons were much stiffer than the neighboring glial cells. So there are definitely mechanical inhomogeneities in this tissue. And if you think about these cells, they have a very special shape, and then they are not like just a round blob or something. We could expect it to be homogeneous, at least within one cell, but you might expect also mechanical differences within one single given cell. So we have chosen these radioglia cells found in the retina called Müller cell to study local mechanical properties along a cell. So you have a very special shape. You have a stoma here in the middle, which contains a nucleus. You have two stem processes, which are densely packed with cytoskeletal elements. This process here, the outer process, is tightly filled with microtubules, while this one here is densely packed with intermediate filaments, the way mainly with bimentin. And then you have this funnel-like structure up here, which is called end foot, and this contains mainly smooth endoplasmatic reticulum. And when we measured mechanical properties of these different cell parts, we found differences that were highly significant. So the stiffest cell part was the cell body here, which contains a nucleus, this blue line here. Again, Young's storage modulus over frequency. And this end foot, which actually doesn't really contain much cytoskeleton, which we thought should be soft, was way stiffer than both processes, which are densely filled with cytoskeletal elements. So that surprised us, and we still don't have really an explanation why it is like this, but this is just measured data. One thing that is important in this slide, which I ask you to keep in mind, is that the stiffness of these two long radial processes here barely reaches 200 pascals. It's an important number to remember for later. All right. So let me summarize this first part. So we know that nerve tissue is mechanically highly inhomogeneous, and that these inhomogeneities are on a micron scale. And this means that, particularly during development, many cells have to migrate through this tissue. Neurons send out their axons and processes that have to grow through this tissue. And all these migrating and growing cells will encounter lots of different, mechanically different, like obstacles in their way. So there's a good chance that they feel that they have a mechanism to feel and to respond to these differences in mechanics. And Paul has already shown us this morning that neurons actually do feel and respond to mechanical cues in their environment. And the same for glial cells. So also glial cells in the central nervous system migrate, especially in pathologies. I will come to this later. All right, so, and that's why I basically started investigating mechanosensitivity. Sorry. Yeah?
These are also done with the AFM?
This is AFM measurements, yeah, of acutely isolated cells. I don't use cell lines or, yeah, all right. All right, so mechanosensitivity of neurons first. So let me introduce my cell system. I'm using neurons of from Xenopus, which are these frogs here. I'm taking Xenopus embryos, actually. I'm taking out the eyeballs at a certain stage, which is, this is such a embryonic eyeball here. And this is at a stage before the retinal ganglion cells, which are the cells that send out their axons, which all come together in one spot, which is the blind spot in our eye. They send the axons out through and to build the optic nerve, which then go to the brain. And if you take out these eyeballs right before these axons are sent out of the eye, you can put the embryonic eyeballs on your cell culture substrate, and the axons will finally or eventually grow out. That's, this has certain advantages. First of all, you know that you're only studying axons, so there are no neurites. So to remind you, a neuron has one axon and lots of dendrites. Yeah, sorry, dendrites. So this is only axons here. And the cell bodies are actually in their natural environment. They are located in the retina within this eyeball here. And all the nutritions that they need are stored there. So you can culture them for 2 to 3 days without needing to supply any nutrition. And the next nice thing about this is it's a frog, so it doesn't care about temperature. You know, you don't have to do the experiment at 37 degrees. You can just do it at room temperature. It's a very convenient system. So, and when I put these eyeballs now on substrate of different compliance, I found a couple of features. So, number one, what you see here is on the left-hand side, these eyeballs are cultured on very compliant substrates with a compliance of roughly CNS tissue. This one here has a compliance of maybe liver tissue, and this one here, you can imagine, is as stiff as a muscle. And the first finding that we did is that the axon outgrowth differs significantly on those culture substrates. So axons seem to grow faster and longer on these stiffer substrates. Furthermore, I hope you can see it somehow, the shape of the growth cones differed. Actually, it was the opposite way that the growth cones that Paul showed us this morning did. So here, you can guess, hopefully, that the growth cones here are very flat and big. And here on the soft substrate, they are just very, very tiny and have mostly just some spike-like protrusions, what we call filopodia. And this is actually how they look like in vivo. And finally, we also looked at fasciculation. So when these axons grow towards their destination in the brain, you have some pioneering axons, which are just looking for guidance cues in their environment, and they determine basically the pathway. And all the following axons, or most of the following axons, just follow this one axon. They don't care about guidance cues anymore in their environment. They just follow this pioneering axons. And so they basically all stick together, and this is called fasciculation. And if you now look at fasciculation on these very compliant substrates, you see that it basically doesn't really happen. So they grow separately. They might touch each other occasionally, but grow away from each other again. And if you look at this fasciculation on stiffer substrates, this looks different. So here, here you see that these axons tend to stick together and to form bundles, and they're really actively, they pull on each other and try to stick together. You can see this here and up here somewhere. So there are clear differences. All right? And this is how actually axonal growth in the tecton looks like. So this is data from in vivo. So this is how the axons of these embryonic eyeballs grow within the brain towards the tecton here. And occasionally in my cultures on substrates of intermediate stiffness, I saw pictures that really resembled this one here. That was really interesting. It's not very reproducible. Just some of the eyeballs do it sometimes, and I have no idea what's different in these. But there is some mechanical effect, that's for sure. So what I want you to take home from these first slides is just that neurons or axons are able to respond to mechanical cues in their environment. And now let's think about why. How is it possible? So how would you know how stiff something is? Just imagine you go to a supermarket, you want to buy a tomato, and of course you don't want to buy these old squishy ones, right? They are not tasty. But you don't necessarily see if they are old and squishy or if they are fresh and just nice. You don't smell it, you don't see it. You could probably taste it, but the owner of the supermarket probably wouldn't like this. So the way you probe the mechanical properties, you take the tomato and you squeeze it. So you apply force and you look how it responds. And this is probably the same way the neurons have to probe their mechanical environment. So to study this, we did some substrate deformation assays. So we basically cultured neurons on compliant substrate, elastic substrate, that with embedded fluorescent beads, latex beads, as you see here in this image. And we cultured these neurons on these substrates. So if the growth cones, which actually determine to the end of the neuronal processes, which determine the direction of growth and the speed of growth, if they exert forces on their environment, this should result in a displacement of beads. So we basically just took images of confocal images of these growth cones on the substrates, and then we released the neurons with trypsin, and we took another image of these beads, and then we tracked the bead displacement, and by applying a cross-correlation analysis, you come to these deformation fields, and we found indeed that neuronal growth cones constantly pull on their environment. We just had this discussion over lunch. It's nothing static. It's rather dynamic. It's really, they do like this at a certain frequency, which is, yeah, below 10 hertz. So, but they pull on their an environment. So they exert forces. And what you see here, the black line is the outline of the growth cone. And the color gives you information about the magnitude of deformation. And the arrows point in the direction of deformation. So you see that the growth cone acts as contractor machinery. It pulls on its environment. And in this case, it's cultured on a substrate of 200 Pascal. And we found that we could resolve substrate deformations up to a substrate stiffness of about 300 Pascal. And this is exactly what we found to be the stiffness of the growth cones themselves, was also 300 Pascal. So it seems that they can visibly deform substrates up to their own stiffness. So they do exert forces, and this is probably the way how they probe their mechanical environment. But how is this force application translated into an intracellular signaling? So we thought, well, let me show this. Oh, I forgot. This is also the 200 Pascal, sorry. This is data from Paul's lab, where they've quantified neuronal branching on substrates of different compliance, and they found the transition of neurons with many branches, so nicely looking neurons basically, to those with significantly less branches on substrates of around 300 Pascal dense modulus. So this is in very well agreement with our results. Coming now to the model, to my little model that I want to suggest how this translation between forces and or mechanical resistance to intracellular signaling is done. So this is just a schematic drawing of a growth cone with some elements in here. And so what we know is that there are contractile elements that pull on their environment. This is actually actin myosin 2 based. the growth cone is adhered to the substrate by molecular complexes, focal adhesions. And what you have the substrate stiffness here, which is just indicated as a spring, and you have the growth cone itself as a stiffness. And all you need is a force sensor somewhere here. So basically, if the substrate is softer than the growth cone, the force exerted will result in the deformation of the substrate, right? But the stiffer the substrate, the more force exerted is exerted actually on the growth cone itself. And there will be a threshold above which the this force sensor here is activated. This is a theory. Very simple model. And so we wanted to assess this force sensor in the experiment. So how do you do this? So you have the cell membrane underlying actin cortex and somewhere embedded force sensors. And so the cell would activate them by exerting forces, by pulling on them. But we thought, well, if it looks like this, we should also be possible. It should also be possible to activate these force sensors by applying a force externally with a bead. And that's what we've done. That's what we've done with an atomic force microscope again. So what you see here is a neuron down here, some neuronal processing, some branching going on here. This is the cantilever. Here you can see the bead. And we will apply a well-defined mechanical stress to this growth cone here. And this is what we observed. So immediately after force application, the growth cone detaches, and the neurite is retracted until it eventually readheres to the substrate and grows out in a slightly new direction, actually. Interestingly, this behavior was threshold dependent. So when we applied stresses below 300 piconewton per square micrometer, these neurites didn't care about this. They would just grow in the same direction, same speed. But above this threshold, we observed this behavior, and it seems to be an all-or-none response. So, which suggested to us that there are indeed some kind of force sensors in this growth cone. On the other hand, it was also possible that we just destroyed these growth cones or these adhesions by pushing on them with a scanning force microscope. These neurites are under tension, so they would contract anyway if we just destroy the focal adhesion. So we thought, well, if this is active, there should be like calcium involved, because calcium is the second messenger. And before I come to the calcium experiment, ask you to look at this deformation of the neurite, which is also interesting. So when it retracts, it's assumed a coiled shape or something like this. And this coiled shape is also seen in experiments where biochemical guidance cues, repellent guidance cues, have been applied. In these experiments also, the axons assume these coiled shapes. So it seems that with our mechanical stimulus, we trigger a similar downstream intracellular mechanism that retracts the whole thing. And so we thought, if it's an active process, if the growth cone detachment is active, calcium should be involved, because calcium is the second messenger that is involved in many active cell processes, especially if the cytoskeleton and or focal adhesions are involved. So in the next experiment, we took again neurons here. Hope you can see it. The color gives you information about the calcium, intracellular calcium level. And there's some branching, and we will again exert mechanical stress with a cell poker on this growth cone. And this is what we observed. So immediately after force application, there was an immense increase in intracellular calcium. And actually, this movie here is on the second time scale, so the whole movie takes like 30 seconds. The movie that you have seen before is on a minute time scale. That was almost half an hour. So the calcium influx precedes the retraction. When we remove calcium from the extracellular medium, we could not trigger the retraction anymore. And when we applied gadolinium to the medium, which is a known blocker, unspecific blocker of stretch-activated ion channels, we also could not trigger this retraction anymore. So let me summarize what we found so far. Neurons do respond to externally applied mechanical stresses. There seem to be stretch-activated ion channels in the growth cone membrane. And which trigger, and then their activation of these, the activation of these channels triggers an influx of calcium from the extracellular space into the cell, and this calcium influx then causes directly or indirectly the retraction of the neurite. So what does this mechanism mean for a neuron that just grows in this mechanically inhomogeneous environment? So this basically is just a drawing. So we found an answer, what this poor sensor here might be. I want to suggest that this is a stretch-activated ion channel. And if now a neuron grows in the mechanically, if it grows in on soft substrates, it will just grow and grow. But if it encounters a stiff obstacle here, it will probe its mechanical properties. And if this obstacle here exceeds a certain threshold in stiffness, the force exerted by the growth cone will lead to the activation of the force sensor, will lead to the opening of the stretch-activated ion channel, which will then lead to an influx of calcium into the cell, to a retraction of the growth cone, and to outgrowth in a slightly different direction. Which means that if I culture cells on stiff substrate, I would expect calcium influxes into the cell because the growth cone would continuously probe the stiff environment. Does it make sense? While on soft substrate, this shouldn't happen. So it's known that the neurons show, biologists call it spontaneous calcium influxes. They call it spontaneous because they don't know any reason for them. They just observe them. So let me show you how this looks like. Can you actually see this? So this is what you should see here is actually axons growing in this direction, and there is
the acid with a calcium dye.
I don't know if we can make this a bit darker somehow. Probably not. Let's see if you can. Well. Can you see it better? All right, yeah.
All right, thank you very much.
So what I hope you see here is that on very compliant substrates, there are occasional increases in intracellular calcium in some of the axons, right? And if I culture the same cells on a stiff substrate, that's what we see. So look at this growth cone here, for example. It's really flickering going on. There is very, very high frequency of intracellular calcium increases, which is in very good agreement with my model. So just compare calcium, the number of calcium fluxes here with here. And when you quantify this, you see that there are highly significant differences between neurons grown on soft and stiff substrates. And the second consequence of my model, if this is true, would be that neurons retract from stiff obstacles. Maybe not as much as you've seen in this movie, because neurons in vivo have lots of adhesion sites, so they will probably just retract a tiny little bit, but then they grow out in a new direction. So this should overall result in the growth away from stiffer substrates, right? Along, towards soft. And to see if this really happens, I developed cell culture substrates incorporating a gradient of mechanical properties. Paul has mentioned something like this already this morning. I also checked different cell types, and as Paul, I have problems to see like haptotaxis with other cell types, but with these axons, it's different. So what we do, we just do an automated quantification of growth direction of axon segments. Important to know is that clockwise growth has a positive angle and counterclockwise growth is negative. So in these gradients, there is a fluorescent dye incorporated so that I can visualize the gradient, which allows me to adjust the image in a way that really I can see where the gradient is along. And here you have a segmented picture. The gradient is like indicated here, so stiff would be up here, down is up here, and then I divide this picture into four quadrants, and I compare the orientation of axons in these quadrants. And if these axons are really growing towards soft, you would expect that on this side, in these two quadrants here, you would have a gain in clockwise growth towards soft, and here in counterclockwise growth. This is only preliminary data, but in all four eyeballs that we looked at so far, it was really the case that there was a slight increase in growth direction towards compliant substrates. And this is very important, and this is what I want to suggest now, that neurons may use mechanical cues as guidance cues during their growth. Let me show you some picture of, this is a schematic of a retina. So retina has a highly organized structure, it's layered, and all synapses in the retina are restricted to those layers where the glia cells are the softest. Let me remind you, these are the radioglia cells that I showed you in the beginning. And we found that their processes have a stiffness not exceeding 200 Pascal, which is below the stiffness that we found for different types of growth cones. So what I think is that neurons send out their processes and they are feeling very well and happy in an environment which is soft or compliant, and that they just use this mechanical signaling, of course, in addition to lots of biochemical signaling which is going on, to find their way and to find their place. And also in neuronal development, in the cortex, for example, neurons are born in the so-called ventricular zone down here, and they migrate towards the cortical surface. And this embryonic tissue is rich in these radioglia cells, which connect both surfaces. And the neurons that migrate from the ventricular zone towards the cortical surface, they always migrate along radioglia cells. So they attach to them and they migrate along them, along these radioglia cell processes, which are pretty soft. So, and this is what I want to suggest here, that neurons are really using mechanical cues as guidance cues during development. And, in the last part of my talk, I will come to glia cells. Paul has already shown us that astrocytes do respond to mechanical properties of their environment. And we reproduced this experiment, and there's not much to add. This is just very convincing, I think. You see these round glia cells on compliant substrate and much more spread astroglia on these stiff substrates. What we found was that on these soft substrates, you occasionally have these astrocytes which look like stars, so like the astrocytes that I've shown you in the historical drawings in the beginning. So they, even if it's only 2D, they resemble much closer to what is found in vivo. So they really like, I'm not sure if they really prefer stiff or if they just grow better on stiff, whatever grow better means. So it's very hard to define when a cell feels well. Is it good that an astrocyte is spread, or is it good that it sits around and is doing nothing? I don't know. So we quantified a couple of morphological characteristics, like diameter, elongation, and so on, and we fed this into a artificial intelligence approach to distinguish these five cell categories here. And yeah, we found highly significant differences of astrocytes cultured on soft and stiff. And actually, there's more than only astrocytes in the brain. There's also these microglia that we talked about it earlier today. And microglia, as was mentioned before, are basically responsible for unspecific immune response in our brain. So usually they have this ramified shape, so they have lots of processes, they are sitting there, but the processes are always highly motile, so they are constantly like probing their environment. And in so-called microglia activation states, microglia get extremely migratory, and they also assume this flat shape. So this flat shape is used as a marker for activation of these cells. And when we put microglia on these polyacrylamide gels of different stiffness, we also found pretty much the same as we found for astrocytes. So they're round and doing not much on soft cells, while they are flat and extremely migratory, actually, on these compliant gels. And I think this is very, very important for certain pathologies in the brain. We talked about deep brain stimulations today and yesterday too. and about the decay of functionality of the electrodes that you put into brain tissue. So what I want to suggest is that mechanics is really a factor. So these electrodes are usually chemically inert, so there's probably no chemical signaling going on that tells astrocytes and microglia to form scar tissue around it. This is basically an in vitro reproduction, what happens if you put an electrode into brain tissue. This is a so-called in vitro foreign body reaction assay done by this group here. And what they did, they just took a brain tissue, took a culture which contained different types of cells of this brain tissue, and they just put an electrode in there. And they waited for 2 weeks, and that's what they found. So in the vicinity of the electrode, there were activated microglia cells, and surrounding these activated microglia cells, you had a layer of activated astrocytes. And this resembles what you find in vivo. So there is activated glia cells coming towards the electrode, towards the foreign body, and they build a scar tissue, like, which decreases functionality of electrodes. And this is a very well-known problem, and it's not really understood. And so we reproduce this in vivo foreign body reaction, but we didn't use an electrode, but rather polyacrylamide gels of different stiffness. So, and when we put some stiff gel in these cultures, we also observed an accumulation after 2 weeks of activated microglia cells close to the stiff polyacrylamide gel, which is stiff as muscles, so still orders of magnitude softer than electrodes, but stiff for a neuron. It's stiff for a glia cell. And also we found activated astrocytes at these hard gels. However, when we took compliant gels, we did not see this. So this is the same culture condition, same cells, same microscope settings, same camera settings. So, and you don't see any activation of microglia cells or accumulation of microglia cells, and you don't see activation or accumulation of astrocytes. So, and this is what I think is might really be important for the design of electrodes in the future. I think that this foreign body reaction that you have in the brain, that this might be at least in part due to mechanical signaling. So glia cells can feel the mechanical properties of the environment, and they spread on stiff substrates, and they are activated. And if you would soften these electrodes, either soften the material or you just coat them with a layer of something which is soft, but they recognize as soft, then I think this mechanical signaling would not happen anymore. And this might result in a highly improved lifetime and functionality of these devices. And that's what I want to end my talk with. So I don't think I need to convince you that mechanics is important in the brain. But I think I could show you that brain tissue is mechanically extremely inhomogeneous, that both neurons and glia cells do respond to their mechanical environment, and that they may use mechanical signaling to find their way during growth and migration, in development and also in pathology. So whenever neuron grows, also after a spinal cord injury, for example, Paul mentioned the glia scar. He said it already. So glia scar is supposed to be stiffer than healthy CNS tissue. We are currently measuring glia scar tissue. It really seems like it is stiffer. So it might just be that neuron is repelled by the stiff scar while glia cells are attracted to it just due to mechanics. I mean, there's of course lots of chemical signaling going on, which is important too. But I don't think it is good to ignore mechanics. And yeah, that's what I want to end my talk with. Thank you for your attention. And I'm happy to answer questions.